the mitzvah of Pirsumei Nisa, of publicizing the miracle, is not merely to let people know that God did a good trick, that he made oil burn 7 days longer than it should have burned, because that is not really honorable to God. Because if one thinks about it, that's what God can do. He can make oil burn longer. He can make the oil to begin with. He could make nothing burn, right? He doesn't need something to have to burn. So publicizing good tricks, supernatural things that God did, doesn't really give honor to God. The idea of Pirsumei Nisa is that every once in a while, God has to catch our attention with something that to us appears to be out of the natural order, and in order to teach us a lesson. And therefore, the Pirsumei Nisa, the publicizing of the miracle, is to publicize the lesson of the miracle, not just to publicize the fact that there was a miracle. And the Rambam says that Pirsumei Nisa, the way he describes it, is laharos ulegalos eshanes, to show and to uncover what the miracle was, meaning, what's the lesson? What are you supposed to learn from it? So I just want to speak about today, what are we supposed to learn from the miracle of Hanukkah? And in order to understand that, we have to understand what exactly the tzara was, what the threat of the Greeks was to the Jewish people, and how we were saved from that, and what it teaches us. So we'll start with the following. In the Al-Hanisim of Hanukkah and the Al-Hanisim of Purim, the structure is pretty much the same. But there's one word missing that appears in the Al-Hanisim of Purim that doesn't appear in the Al-Hanisim of Hanukkah structure-wise. Both start out, Bimei Mordechai ve'Esther b'Shushan Abira, similar to Bimei Matisyahu ben Yochanan, Kohen Gadol Chashmonoi Uvanot. It introduces the period of history that we're talking about, and who the tzaddikim, the righteous people, were who played an important part in this special period of history. Then, Kishomar Aleim Homan Arasha, Kishom the Malchus Yovan Harashal Amcha Yisrael. Similar, right, idea. Now we introduce the wicked people of that generation. Who were the players that were the evil people? Haman and Malchus Yovan. And now, what did the evil people want to do? What was the problem? Bikesh lahashmid larog ulabeit, right? So Haman wanted to destroy the Jewish people. What should be the next word in the Al-Hanisim of Hanukkah? Bikshu lahashkicham torasecha. They wanted to make us forget the Torah. But that word, bikshu, is missing. It doesn't say bikshu lahashkicham torasecha. They wanted to make us forget the Torah. It just says lahashkicham torasecha, to make them forget the Torah. Why? Could have said the same thing on Purim too. Could have said kishom aleim haman arasha lahashmid larog ulabeit. Why by Purim does it say bikesh lahashmid larog ulabeit? And by Chanukah say, does not say bikshu lahashkicham torasecha. So I was thinking a very simple answer. And that is that Haman presented no threat. There was no tzara until he sought to do something. When he decreed annihilation on the Jewish people, that's when the tzara started. The day before he decreed annihilation, there was no tzara. But by Yavan, before they chose to do anything, before they sought to do anything, before Bikshu, before they made the first decree against us, there was a danger already. Just the emergence of Greek culture as a dominant force in the world was a danger to the Jewish people. Before they sought to do anything, before they had any designs on us at all. The proof that years and years before the decrees of the Greeks, there already were Jews who became Hellenists, who fell to the influence of this culture. So the Greeks were not a threat because of what they wanted to do to us. The Greeks were a threat because of what they were. Kishom Amar Aleihem Malchus Yovan Harashah al Amcha Yisrael, that itself was Rashticham Torah Secha. That in itself made us forget the Torah. That in itself was an idea of La Vira Michuke Ritzonecha. We have to understand what the influence of Greek culture was that was so threatening to the Jewish people, and why so many people fell prey to this influence. Without going into great detail, because I really want to go into great detail of other things here, and we don't have that much time. Basically, Greek culture represented a total obsession with the physical external world, at the denial almost of anything spiritual in this world, anything beyond the external physical world. They deified external beauty. They made what's it called their gods into basically superhuman beings. Human beings who had all the foibles of human beings. They stole, they murdered, they were immoral, but they were super beings. That was the pantheon of Greek gods. They made a religion of sport, of external strength, of the body, of beauty, external beauty, external wisdom, chokhma chitzonis, logic. No nesora, no internal divine wisdom, just logic, just everything external. They made a culture of external physical with the absence of anything spiritual. And I think the name Yavan represents that. The name Yavan in Hebrew is spelled with three letters, Yud, Vav, and Nun. Those are three lines that have nothing inside. They're just lines. And when you look at the world from a totally physical standpoint, so you measure it in quantity. When you look at the world with a spiritual content, then you measure it in quality, not in quantity. Spiritualism is measured in quality, not in quantity. In the world of quantity, the three generic quantities that quantify this world are small, medium, and large. That's Yavan. Small yud, medium-sized vav, large nun. Three lines with nothing inside that come in the three generic sizes. In addition, the three lines are parallel. They never meet. In a physical world, everything is separate. In a spiritual world, there's unity. There's something that draws them together. But physically, we're all separate. So Yavan is three external letters in the three generic sizes of quantity that are parallel and never meet. That represents what Yavan was. Yavan was this external. Also, the word Yavan, if you turn it around backwards, is noi, beauty. Because beauty does play a part in this world. We'll see in a little while where beauty comes in the world. But the Yavanim took what real beauty is and turned it inside out. Turned it around completely. They totally made an aberration of it, distorted it completely. And the Jewish people at the time, many of them were Nisrashel Ba'avoda. The Bach says in his commentary to the Tour, what was the weakness of the Jewish people that made them vulnerable to the Greeks? Nisrashlu Ba'avoda Sashem. They were derelict, weak in the service of the Beit HaMikdash, the Karbanos, the Mikdash. Why? Because all of that represented the inner value of Judaism, the Shechina that dwelt amongst the Jewish people. They kept Torah and Mitzvahs, but they kept it in a very cold, external way. They kept mitzvahs, a mitzvah here, a mitzvah there. They did. They went through the motions, but they didn't realize that mitzvahs have to engender a lifestyle, values, standards. That be more than just things that people do. It has to seep into the inside of your way of life. And they didn't see that. So they missed the inner Shechina that's represented by the Beit HaMikdash, by Kedusha, by holiness, and they just kept a bunch of commands, a bunch of things. In fact, the Navi describes a life like that as Tzav le Tzav, Kav le Kav. a command here, a command there, a line here, a line there. Just like we said, Yavan is represented by lines. Nothing with an inside. Nothing with any content. No inner spiritual content. So the Jews kept the mitzvahs, tzav l'tzav, a command here, a command there, a line here, a line there. It was just a bunch of lines. It's things to do. But it didn't form a lifestyle. Didn't affect their values, their standards, their goals. And therefore, when a Jew approaches the Torah from an external standpoint, viewpoint, so he is extremely impressed by the externals of Greece. Because the externals of Greece are much more impressive than the externals of the Torah. But when a Jew appreciates the inner spiritual value of the Torah, then he's not affected by Greece at all. Because the externals of Greece can't possibly compete with the inner spiritual value of the Torah. The Chafetz Chaim says that sometimes when people don't appreciate what they have, so in order to make them appreciate it, God sometimes threatens to have it taken away or takes it away from them. You know when you appreciate things? When you don't have them anymore. We appreciate our parents most, lo aleinu, when they're not here anymore. We appreciate our gedolim the most when they're not here anymore. Now, things that you have, you take for granted. And things that you are in danger of losing or lost, then you really appreciate them. So the Rabbanu Shel Olam let the Greeks make decrees. They will be punished for what they did. They did it for evil reasons. But God permitted them to be successful because we needed to be reminded of how important it is what we have. And by having it threatened by on the outside to be taken away from us, and we got a greater appreciation of what that was. So the Greeks made decrees to try and destroy, not destroy the Jewish people, not destroy the Beis HaMikdash. The two words that are used in conjunction with what the Greeks wanted to do to us negatively are the words lechalel ulatameh, to desecrate and defile. Now, I don't know what those words mean in English. I mean, I know what they mean, but I'll tell you what the source of them is in Hebrew. The word lechalel, chalal, means a vacuum. Chalal hashamayim means outer space, empty space. A dead body is called a chalal because he's hollow. He has nothing inside. Just a body. The no neshama, the neshama left. A chalil is a flute because it's hollow on the inside. In fact, I'm sure that the etymology of the word hollow is from the word halal. H-O-L-L explains why there's a double L. Is halal. Hollow is halal. With an O-W, ow, afterwards, I don't know where the ow got in. Maybe somebody got stepped on by a halal and exclaimed ow and it became hollow. But in any case, the word hollow for sure has a connection to the word in Hebrew halal. Hollow. They wanted to extract any inner meaning from Judaism, the chalel, to make hollow, and letameh, the word tameh is the same thing. Tuma, the Sfarim explain, whatever there was a concentration of holiness, and the holiness left, a human being has a soul, and the soul left, he died, what's left, the vacuum that's left is tuma, or it's filled with tuma. But that is what tuma is. Tuma is the vacuum that is left when Kedusha leaves the place. And therefore, the more Kedusha there was, the more Tumah there is. A Jew is Matami more than a Goy more than an animal. Because the vacuum left is greater when there was greater Kedusha there to begin with. So what did the Yavanim wanted to do? They wanted Lechalel to extract any inner meaning from Judaism and desecrate it, make it hollow. And therefore, Tumah, let Tumah fill that vacuum, not Kedusha. Should be nothing on the inside. What did they make decrees against? They made decrees against the following things. The most famous is Rosh Chodesh, Shabbos, and Milah. Why? Because these three things represent the totality of existence. The world exists on three dimensions. The macrocosm, that's the big universe, that's called Olam. And then there's the microcosm, that's man, who is a little universe. and then there's time. There's space and there's time. As Einstein said, the time is the fourth dimension. The rabbis already knew that way before Einstein. Space and time are coordinates that go together. And therefore there is the larger space and the smaller space, the larger universe and the small universe. There's the world and there's man. And then there's time. So they wanted to extract the inner value of all these things. The world, the body of the world was created in 6 days. What did Shabbos add? It didn't add anything to the body of the world. It added a neshama. It added a inner meaning, spirituality to this world. That's a hint to the world to come. So they wanted us to stop keeping Shabbos, to leave the world that we deal with as a body without a soul. They wanted us to stop having bris milah, because the body is a body, a bunch of chemicals. Bris milah shows that that body has a connection to God. There's a soul. There's something spiritual about that body. They wanted to destroy that spirituality. And lastly, Rosh Chodesh, time. Time is also a body, an empty body. And kill time. Waste time. Use time for the most external, meaningless things. What infuses time with holiness? Rosh Chodesh. Kiddush HaChodesh. We sanctify our time. And from that comes all the Yomim Tovim. Kaddish Yisroel v'Hazmanim. God sanctifies the Jewish people and time. And our idea of sanctifying time is Rosh Chodesh. So they wanted to take the Kedusha, the holiness, out of time. In addition, it says in the Al HaNisim, Lahashkicham Torasecha. They wanted us to forget the Torah. Not that they wanted to take away the Torah completely, because the written Torah you can't forget. You can only forget the oral Torah. They were willing to let us keep the written Torah. They were willing to let us fulfill mitzvahs, but only as folk customs, as folklore, as totally external things. When the Greeks conquered a nation, they didn't force that nation to adopt all of the gods and all of the customs of Greece. They let them have their own customs, their own folklore, with one condition, that the underpinnings of the society was basically a Greek lifestyle. That every nation that they conquered had their idiosyncrasies, their individual way of expressing that lifestyle. But it had to be a Greek lifestyle, where the externals were the main thing. And therefore, they didn't care if we had a Torah. Because every nation has its book of history, its Bible. But when the Torah is just the written Torah, it's a bunch of stories, it's history. That's what they learn in the secular schools here. They learn it as history. And it has no effect on anybody. You know when the Torah becomes alive? When there's a Torah Shebaal Peh, when there's an oral Torah that gives it life, that gives it meaning on an ongoing basis. And therefore the Mishnah, which is the oral Torah, is the same letters as Neshama. Because the Mishnah is the Neshama of the Torah. So Lahashkicham Torah Secha, they wanted us to forget the Torah, they wanted to take Torah Shebaal Peh away from us. And Lahavira Mechuke Ritzonecha means to transfer them from the chukim, from the chok is a statute. But more, chok is a limit, is a framework. They wanted to transfer us from the framework of God's will to a different framework completely. In modern Hebrew, a ha'avara, you go to the bank, you make a ha'avara, you're making a transfer from one account to another. They want to destroy the account, they just want to transfer it to a different account. Instead of us serving God in an internal, spiritual way, and the mitzvahs being representations of that, they wanted the mitzvahs just to be folk customs. You know, goyim roll Easter eggs and we search our house. No difference. It's just all a bunch of folk customs. There's nothing internal, there's no meaning to it. It's not something that represents an inner lifestyle, it's just things you do. Because that's, you know, tradition. So those are the things that they wanted to do. They would have let us keep many of the mitzvahs, but they wanted them to just be external things. They wanted to extract all the internal meaning by taking out Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, Bris Milah, Torah Shebaal Peh, That way they thought that they could reduce Judaism to just a folk ways. The two other things the Rambam says that they also targeted, Upashtu Yideihem Bimamonam Ubibnosehem. They also made decrees against Jewish money and Jewish women. The money, the Medrash says, what were the decrees against money? There are various Medrashim, but there's a Medrash that says that if a Jew wanted to own any material, physical property, he had to write on it, Ein lanu chelek b'elokei Yisrael. I have no share in the God of Israel. They had to write that on the thing, right? So if he wanted to own a tape recorder, he had to inscribe it, right? I have no share in the God of Israel. If he wanted to own an ox, he had to write on its horn, Ein lanu chelek b'elokei Yisrael. If he wanted to own a house, he had to write on the house, Ein lanu chelek b'elokei Yisrael. Why money? Because here again is a very big difference between the philosophy of Greek and the philosophy of Judaism concerning money. Money, you would think, for righteous people isn't so important, but it's not true. The Gemara says, Tzadikim chavivim aleihem mamonam yoser migufam. A tzaddik, his money is more precious to him than his body. Why so much? Because he doesn't steal. And what does that mean? So you would think that tzaddikim, that money is not important. Money is not an important thing, that it's more precious to them than their body. Because a tzaddik understands that money is a tool to serve God. When everybody has their part in this world, like you have a part in the play, in order to really fulfill your part, you need your costume and you need your props. So every single person comes into this world, God gives them a costume that's called your body. And he gives you the props, that's your material possessions that you need to fulfill your part. And everything is with a cheshbon. Everything is meted out exactly what you need to do your part. If you have a lot of money, you don't have extra. It just means your part necessitates you to use a lot of material things. The court jester in a play may have 10 props, whereas the king or queen only has one prop. That doesn't make the court jester more important than the king or queen. It means that to fulfill his role, he needs 10 props. So the court jester can't say, I have more than I need. King only has one. I have 10. I have 9 extra. No, you don't have anything extra. Your part depends on 10 props. And every one is necessary. Otherwise, you can't do your part properly. So the tzaddik looks at money as not something that by having it, it's important. It's how you use it. It's function. You use it as an utensil, as something to serve God with. It's a means to use to serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. And his body, the same thing. Which is more precious? What creates something to be precious? How much effort you put into it. The more effort, the more precious it is. The less effort, the less precious. How much effort do you have to put in securing your body, getting your body? None. It's a birthday present. First birthday, God gave you a body for free. No effort on your part at all. And how much effort you have to put into maintaining your body? Quite a lot. How much effort you have to put into using your body? Also quite a lot. So out of three possible kinds of effort, two of them apply to the body and one doesn't. How about money? How much effort you have to put into securing, to getting your money? If you don't steal, a lot. If you steal, it may be easy to get money. But tzaddikim don't steal. So they have to put in effort in getting their money. Then they have to put effort into maintaining their money. Then they have to put effort into using their money. Out of three possible efforts, all three apply to money. So which is more precious? Both of them are utensils to be used in service of God. The money involves more effort than the body, so the money is more precious to the tzaddik. But when it comes to Greece, to an external view of the world, money is not important only because of its function. It's important because of its just having it. There are people who don't even have time to spend their money. They just want to amass more and more and have it. Having money makes you important. I was once in New York visiting after I moved here, maybe 2-3 years after we moved here. I was back in New York in a snowstorm and I was forced to take a taxi cab. Again, the cab, and the driver in a deep Hebrew Israeli accent says to me, you look Jewish. I said, you're very perceptive. I guess I do look Jewish. Wasn't trying to hide it. I said, you sound Israeli. He said, yeah, you're also perceptive. I'm Israeli. So he said to me, where do you live? I said, I live in Israel. He said, where do you live? He said, I live here in America. I said, okay, you're an Israeli who lives in America. I'm an American who lives in Israel. I said, he says to me, are you happy? I said, very. I said, now are you happy? He said, no. I said, well, why not? You probably moved to America because financially you're probably doing better driving this cab than you would have been in Israel. He said, yeah, I'm financially better off here, and that's exactly why I moved here. Okay. He said, but I'm not happy here. He says, because, and this was not a religious man. This didn't appear to be, and he didn't, from what he told me, what didn't appear to be a big Shomer Torah mitzvahs, at least externally. So he said, I'll tell you the truth. He said, in Israel, my friends judged me on what I was, not what I owned. And here, you are judged only on how much you have. That's the only thing that makes a difference, and I can't stand that. So that is the Greek, the external look at money. I remember there was a woman in Miami. She was known as the bag lady. She used to have all her possessions in a shopping cart and push the shopping cart around Miami Beach all day. She used to scrounge for her meals in the garbage. Right? Poor lad. She was called. She wore rags. She was famous. And then I saw an article in the paper. This woman died. They didn't find her for like 2-3 days in a tenement that she lived in. But wonder of wonders, when they went into that tenement and she didn't have any relatives, they found millions of dollars in bills hidden in the mattresses and the walls. She obviously was crazy. I just feel bad she wasn't my relative. All her money went to the state of Florida. That's what happens if you don't have a will. And, but why? Okay, obviously this is sick and absurd, but that's it. Money is what you have. There are people who work to earn more and have more in their bank account, and they never have a chance to enjoy it. They work themselves into an early grave, and even they convince themselves doing it to their family is miserable. But they earn more and more and more just to have. It's not the neshama of the money that's important. It's the body of the money, having it. So there's a tremendous difference between the Greek philosophy of money and the Torah philosophy. According to both of them, are important. The question is the importance, the body, or is the importance the function, the soul of that money? And the next things that they decreed against were women. Why women? Because here also there's a tremendous dichotomy between the philosophy of women in the secular world and in the Torah world. From a secular standpoint, women are basically judged on their external qualities. That's it. Even in this modern, liberated world, they still have beauty pageants, in case you haven't been following the news of what's going on in Nigeria, or now in England, right? Beauty contests. And even though in our modern world, they have refined these contests to include content, where the women read poetry that they wrote, where they present papers on their careers, that since they're doing this all in bathing suits, it has me believe that the ichor is not the poetry and the careers. So, still the same thing. Women are judged basically on their external attributes, and that's what a woman is. From the Greek standpoint, that's surely the way things were. And from Torah, on the other hand, we could spend another 2 shiur in discussing the importance of women in a Torah society, but let one thing suffice. What determines if a person is a born Jew or not? If he has a Jewish neshama, he has the holiness of being a Jew. What is that one singular factor that makes that decision or not, makes that determination? Who his mother was. And up until today, mothers have usually been women. So that means that what determines whether a person has a holy Jewish soul is a woman. The woman is the foundation of the holiness of the Jewish people. You could have a father who is the greatest tzaddik in the world, but if your mother wasn't Jewish, you're not Jewish. And your mother could be a simple, plain, pashuta, yidna, nobody special, right? Plain, simple Jewish woman, and the father could be the biggest Russia goy in the world, and the child's Jewish, because the mother makes that determination. So you see that women are the foundation of the Kedusha of the Jewish people. So therefore, the Greeks decreed two things against women. Again, l'tameu v'chalel, to desecrate and to defile. They desecrated marriage. Marriage is called Kedusha, holiness. They desecrated the holiness of marriage by saying that any woman who gets married has to first live with a Greek ruler of that area and have relations with him before she has relations with her husband. That was one decree, to totally desecrate the holiness of marriage and reduce it to just a physical act. And the second decree was married women were not allowed to go to the mikveh. They took away taras, hamishpacha, the purity of marriage, and defiled it. Same two things, desecration and defilement. Same thing they did in the Beit HaMikdash. They desecrated it and they defiled it. They didn't destroy it. So, what did the Rabban Shalom do? The Rabban Shalom inspired, aroused the Kohanim. The Kohanim represent the inner spiritual root of the Jewish people. The Kedusha, the Beit HaMikdash, the Shechina. They're God's servants. And they were the ones that fought against the Greeks. Our power is in our inner spiritual power, not our external physical things. And therefore, the Chashmonoim, who were the ones who fought the Greeks, their name hints to all the things the Greeks wanted to take away from us. What were the things? Chodesh, right? Rosh Chodesh, Shabbos, Ches, Shin, Mila and Mamon, and Mishnah, all Mems, Ches, Shin, Mem, Nida, right, the laws of family purity, and Eishes Ish, the fact when a woman had to get married, so she had to live with somebody else first. That's adultery. Those are the five decrees. That's the words, Chashmona. And Chashmonai means like Yerushalmi, Bnei Braki, Tel Avivi. The Yud is just to show who you are, Chashmonai. But Chashmona is the five things, or the more than five things, that the Greeks, with five letters, that represent it. And it's also interesting that what the Greeks tried to take away from us, not only weren't they successful, but because they wanted to take it away, like we said in the beginning, when it's threatened to be taken away, or it's taken away, you appreciate it more, and you intensify it more. So what resulted from their decrees? A new holiday called Hanukkah, which has in it all the things the Greek wanted to take away from us. Every Hanukkah has 8 days, symbolic of Bris Milah. Every Hanukkah has at least one Shabbos, and like this year, sometimes two Shabboses. And it's Shabbos Hanukkah, special Shabbos. Every Shabbos has Rosh Chodesh Teves, every Hanukkah has its Rosh Chodesh Teves in it. Rosh Chodesh, right? And it's a special Rosh Chodesh, because we say the full Hallel on this Rosh Chodesh, because it's Hanukkah. Every Hanukkah has a special place for women. Women, the miracle came through women, and women have special laws on Hanukkah. They don't do work during the half hour that the candles are lit. And every Hanukkah has a special place for money, Hanukkah guilt. So all the things that the Greeks targeted, Chodesh, Shabbos, Mila, women, and money, are included in Hanukkah. They became intensified through Hanukkah. So bottom line, what is the message of Hanukkah? The message of Hanukkah is there doesn't necessarily have to be a conflict between the externals and the internals. There doesn't have to be a conflict between the physical and the spiritual. But if there is, which one is more potent? The spiritual, the inner values, not the externals. The miracle of the oil represented that completely, because it didn't make a difference how much oil. It's how pure it was. A little bit of oil that's pure will last a long time. And tons of oil that's not pure is worthless. So it's not quantity, it's quality that counts. And in fact, that's what we say in the Alanisim. Now, on Nisan we say, the word gadol, start with that. The word gadol appears four times in the Al HaNisim of Hanukkah and no times in the Al HaNisim of Purim. Why four times? Kohen gadol. Ulecha atisa shem gadol. Ulamcha Yisrael atisa teshua gadola. Lahodos ulahala l'shimcha ha-gadol. Why this obsession with the word gadol, big? Because that's exactly what Hanukkah teaches us. What's big? Big Yefesh, the progenitor of Yavan, was big. Yefesh ha-gadol. But their big is quantity. What's our big? The Kohen Gadol, the big Kohen. He was the fattest, tallest Kohen they could find. He was the Kohen Gadol? Of course not. Kohen Gadol could have been a small, short, frail little guy. But he was the Kohen Gadol because he was the most, what's it called, the most spiritual. That was his godliness. It wasn't Gadol because he was tall and fat. So what is Gadol? That's the lesson of Hanukkah. Nesh Gadol, Hayasham, or Khan, or Po, right? What is Nesh Gadol? Gadol is not quantity. Gadol is quality. In the Alanisim we say, Giborim Biad Chaloshim, Ravim Biad Neatim. God gave the strong and the many in the hands of the few and the weak. And then we go on to say, Tmeim Biad Tahorim, the defiled in the hands of the pure, Rishoyim Biad Tzadikim, wicked in the hands of the righteous, Zaydim Biad Oskei Sorasecha. So they ask, I understand the first two are miracles. God did a big miracle. Then the mighty and the many were delivered into the hands of the few and the weak. That's a miracle. But where's the miracle in the defiled in the hands of the pure? The wicked in the hands of the righteous? Is there some written law of nature that righteous, pure people always lose? And if they win, it's a miracle? There's no miracle in that. I was thinking it means something else completely differently. It's not telling us that all these things are miracles. It's telling us the following. We were weak and few, but we didn't win because we were weak and few. We won despite the fact that we were weak and few. So why did we win? So therefore, the Al HaNisim says the following. True, they had the physical edge. They were many and strong. We didn't have the physical edge, but we had a spiritual edge. We were pure, righteous, and we learned Torah. So we had the spiritual edge and they had the physical edge. When it came down to it and there was a conflict between the two, which one won? We won. The spiritual edge overpowered the physical edge. That's the lesson of Hanukkah. And that really is what we say when we sing Mal Sur by the candles. Right? We're singing of empires that had everything going for them physically. Numbers, might, money, land, areas. Right? The empires of Egypt and Babylonia and Persia and Moabite and Greece. All of them had much more physically than we ever had. And where are they? They're in the history books. They're in the encyclopedias. They're not standing by any candle singing about us. But we're still standing by our candle singing about them. The only one left is Edom, who we still have to deal with. All the other ones are basically in the history books. So what does Hanukkah teach us? Hanukkah teaches us that you can have all the physical things going for you, but ultimately it's the spiritual things that persevere. It's the spiritual things that are lasting. And the other ones are put into the dustbin of history. That's the lesson of Hanukkah. And I was thinking, I'm on a no-oil, fat-free diet for the last, since Yom Tov. Extreme. This is not my Yom Tov. Hanukkah, everything revolves around oil. Right, the foods we eat are also oily foods to remember the miracle. In America, we eat latkes. Why do you eat latkes on Hanukkah? Because they're made in oil, and they're dripping with oil, and you can see the oil, so it's a remembrance of the nation. When I came to Eretz Israel, so I'll tell you the truth, I didn't see latkes around. Since Cheshvan, they had, you know, sufganiyot, they had what's it called, jelly donuts. It was totally foreign to my, you know, and then I saw a sign by an army base that what's it called, during Hanukkah, big sign, latkes with an arrow. So I figured, wow, at least the army here celebrates Hanukkah with latkes. And not only that, they publicize it, right? Want to get latkes? There. Then somebody told me it should be read latkes. not rockets. Burst my bubble of how the army celebrates Hanukkah here. But in any case, that is exactly the way latkes are spelled. In any case, so why do you, what's it called? Why do we eat jelly donuts? Same reason, Lechora. Because jelly donuts are also deep fried, and they're made with oil. And my wife made me on Shabbos oil-free, fat-free latkes. It's like having dehydrated water. It's just not a latke. If it doesn't have any oil in it, it's not going to be a latke. I don't know what it was, but it was potato something, and it wasn't a latke. So the same thing goes. You make a jelly donut without oil, there's no purpose of eating it on it. But I was thinking, though, that there's another significance of jelly donuts aside from the fact that they're made in oil, based on what we said. A jelly donut teaches you that it's not the main thing is what's on the outside. The main thing is what's inside. That's what a jelly donut teaches us. And therefore, even a jelly donut without any oil still has some connection to Hanukkah. So I'm waiting for my wife to bake me some oil-free jelly donuts, if you can find the recipe, so at least I can have some food that has some connection to Hanukkah. But that bottom line is the idea of Hanukkah. It also underscores the idea of tznius. In fact, that's the lesson of the menorah. The message of the menorah is... lesson of the menorah we read in this past week's Haftorah was lo b'chayil v'lo b'koach, not with numbers and not with strength, ki im baruchi, Omar Hashem. The main thing is my spirit, not numbers and not strength. That is the lesson of the menorah. That's the lesson of Hanukkah. Just to end, this also underscores the whole concept of tznius. People think that tznius is the body is erotic, dirty, what's it called, and therefore has to be shameful and has to be covered. It's not what tznius is at all. If that would be tznius, then we'd have to cover the bodies of animals too. They're more shameful, right, than a human body. So why don't we make it that you can't go to the zoo unless all the animals are clothed? And except for a few nuts in Los Angeles who dress up their cats and dogs, I don't know anybody who's mocked it that their dogs and cats and goldfish should have clothing on. So what's the idea? So in a nutshell, the body is not the main thing of a human being. The main thing of a human being is a soul. We were souls long before we had bodies, and we'll be souls after we leave our bodies here. The body is a suit of clothing that the soul wears in this world to be able to function in the physical world. Like an astronaut puts on a special suit of clothing in outer space to function. When he comes back to Earth, he takes off that suit of clothing. Here he can function very nicely without it. In outer space, he can't. When we were souls in a spiritual world, we could function very nicely without any body. When we came into a physical world, we needed a special inner space suit to wear to function in a physical world. We need eyes to see and ears to hear and so on. When we leave this world, we leave the suit behind, like the astronaut takes it off when he comes back to Earth. And that's one of the reasons why we reflect mourning for someone who died by tearing our clothes. Just the clothing that's been torn away, but the essence of the person is still there. So, on the other hand, people are attracted to the body. That's what you see. You don't even know if there's an neshama. All you see is a body. So therefore, we distract attention from the external, visible body and make a statement, there's more here than meets the eye. I'm more than a body. And that's why animals don't have to wear clothing. Because there is nothing more in them than the body. What you see is what you get. There's nothing wrong with the body. But when and a human being, you would think that the body is all there is, right? That's not true. You have to make a statement. Don't be attracted overly by what you see, because there's something beneath the surface that you can see that's more important. But that doesn't mean that we totally negate beauty. In fact, Hanukkah time is one of the things of art, is the beautiful Hanukkah menorahs. You would think that if we want to really go against Greece, and they deified beauty, we should have the ugliest Hanukkah menorahs you could find, the most disgusting things, but have no beauty at all, right? And that way we're going against Greece. Says the Vilna Gaon on the Pasuk, Sheker Achein Vehevel Hayofi, Isha Yiras Hashem Itisalo, that charm and beauty are vain and false, but in a woman who fears God, she should be praised. He says what it means is the following. When is charm and beauty vain and false? When there's nothing more. And that's all there is. But in a woman who fears God, she should be praised for her beauty and her charm. What is real tznius? When you have the external beauty reflecting the inner beauty. When they mesh together. That's real tznius. Tznius is not just covering up the parts of your body that have to be covered. Covering them in a way that the way that they're covered expresses that inner holiness that a person has. So when somebody looks at that person, they look refined, they look holy, they represent, they send a message of that inner beauty that's there. That's proper tznius. It's not merely covering your body, it's covering in a way that expresses that inner kedusha. That's real tznius. And therefore, that's also the lesson of Hanukkah, this idea of tznius, of acting in an external way. The externals are important when they express the internals. But if all there is externals, then they're worthless.